Hello and welcome to the Energy Efficiency Podcast, sponsored by EcoFlap Home Draft Proofing Products, the ideal fit-and-forget energy efficiency solutions, including the PetFlap Draft-Proof Pet Door. My name is Heather Lindsay and I'm the Communications Manager for EcoFlap. This weekly podcast will bring you a mix of news, products and tips all year round. We're interested in profiling people and products involved in promoting energy efficiency habits, products and information, so please do get in touch if you have something to contribute. You can reach me at heather@ecoflap.co.uk. This week, LEED, another green building accreditation scheme. How does it differ from BREEAM? City bike hire. Is it an environmental and health success? And energy efficiency in the music industry. Is it hitting the right note? But before we get on with our advertised features, there have been a couple of articles recently about heating homes from local waste or untapped heat. A project in the East End of Glasgow is looking at the potential for heating homes with geothermal energy from untapped mine water. The project is expected to continue for 15 years. It's funded by the Natural Environmental Research Council, NERC, and the British Geological Survey, BGS, as part of the £31 million UK Geoenergy Observatories project. Across the UK, about 9 million buildings sit on former coal fields. That's about a quarter of all UK homes and businesses. Boreholes are being dug into flooded mine workings as part of the Glasgow project. They will be monitored to provide data on water movement, temperature and water chemistry, as well as changes to the chemistry and physical and microbiological properties just below the surface. The Coal Authority believes there's enough geothermal energy in coal mines to heat millions of homes. It's creating a map of potential mine water resources. Systems like this are already in use in other countries, and the Glasgow project is intended to see how much more widely this form of heating could be used. It has potential as a heat store, something which has been a real challenge for renewable heat systems. A similar project is underway in Stoke, and there is even potential for extracting heat from the Clyde. In North London, a scheme is underway to pump heat from a ventilation shaft in the tube network to homes and businesses in Islington by the end of this year. The homes and businesses that will benefit from this scheme are part of a heating scheme in Islington. At the moment, 800 or so homes are heated by the Bunhill Energy Centre, a combined heat and power plant, which for 7 years has provided heat to council houses, schools, a swimming pool and a leisure centre. It generates electricity and uses the heat that is a byproduct to supply hot water. The new addition to this scheme uses heat that would otherwise be wasted. An additional 450 homes will benefit. In summer, the system will be reversed to introduce cool air into the tube tunnels. It's hoped this model can be replicated across London. The GLA reckons heat currently wasted could meet nearly 40% of London's heating requirements. Last week, we looked at BREEAM Sustainable Building Accreditation. This week, we cast our eye over LEED, L-E-E-D, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. One immediate difference between the two is that where BREEAM was developed by a British organisation, the Buildings Research Establishment, LEED is an American development. Other countries have their own systems too, such as Green Star in Australia and Assessment System for Built Environment Efficiency in Japan. Described by Wikipedia as one of the most popular green building certification programs used worldwide, LEED was developed by the US Green Building Council, USGBC. Similarly to BREEAM, LEED is based on a rating system for design, construction, operation and maintenance of buildings aiming to be environmentally sound and efficient in use of resources. The main categories are sustainable sites, water efficiency, energy and atmosphere, materials and resource, and indoor environmental quality. In 2009, regional priority points were added to take into consideration country-specific climates and availability of natural resources. This feature is contentious and research suggests it's inconsistently applied. Interestingly, LEED was initially kick-started by Robert Watson, a scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is an American environmental advocacy group. Over the next few years, a broad base of professionals developed LEED. Like BREEAM, LEED's remit has widened since it first began. It's had to incorporate new green building technologies. LEED standards, which include the social and economic aspects of a project, have now been applied to well over 80,000 projects worldwide. LEED allocates points to a project, quote, based on the potential environmental impacts and human benefits of each credit, ends. It assesses these using standards set by other American organisations. However, some categories attract no credits as they're mandatory for any project pursuing LEED certification. The owner of a building must share its energy and water use data for 5 years. A project being assessed for LEED certification is measured against a set of reference buildings. Empirical data is used to assign points to categories. From 2010, buildings have been able to use carbon offsets to achieve green power credits for new builds. So far, so similar but not identical to BREEAM. BREEAM came first, just, and because it works closely with British building codes, it's less widely used internationally than LEED. LEED is now gaining more traction in the UK and is far more widely used internationally than BREEAM. Countries outside the UK using BREEAM have to adapt it to their building codes. LEED doesn't work with specific building codes, but overlays them, and this makes it far more easily applied internationally. It's more frequently revised than BREEAM and encourages innovation, which could make it more effective than BREEAM at achieving its aims. Due to LEED's international profile, a developer in the UK looking to attract foreign money to a project would be advised to use LEED. Buildings gaining a high LEED score will do well under BREEAM, but buildings achieving a high BREEAM rating may not score quite so well under LEED. One of the key differences between the two systems is the method of certification. Under BREEAM, a licensed assessor collects a building's data and submits it to the parent organisation, the BRE, for assessment. With LEED, the design team collects the data, which it sends to the USGBC for review. The two schemes have slightly different priorities and structures. BREEAM is considered to be more structured, which appeals to some developers and delivers something they value, whereas LEED offers more freedom, which encourages innovation but requires more in-depth and individual assessment and monitoring. Perhaps for this reason, it's considered less hassle to go for BREEAM certification over LEED. The Claris website suggests that BREEAM looks more closely than LEED at the processes behind speccing a building. Where LEED will assess the sustainability of, for instance, a window, BREEAM will audit the emissions and sustainability in the supply chain that went into producing that window. BREEAM prioritises responsible production rather than just a responsible finished product. This is a very fine but really vital distinction. Putting these differences aside, BREEAM, LEED and all the other green building initiatives, of which there are many, are broadly pursuing the same end. Sustainable, energy-efficient buildings that deliver benefits for the owners, the occupants and the neighbourhood. Some big names are going after that LEED badge. Colgate Palmolive aims to achieve LEED certification for all its new buildings globally. It created the first LEED-certified building in Vietnam, a factory outside Ho Chi Minh City. It's also created the first LEED-certified building in India, another factory. Growth in LEED certification of industrial buildings is slower than in its other categories, as it's not easy to achieve. As factories are such heavy users of raw materials, they're a prime candidate for LEED-type measures. Colgate Palmolive wants to cut water usage by half and LEED projects to reduce stress on water supplies in the areas where they operate. It has ambitious plans in all areas of energy efficiency, waste reduction and responsible sourcing. It sees that the projects it undertakes help to raise awareness in the industry and demonstrate what can be done. But it's not all about the new. Moseley Architects is a USGBC partner providing a full buildings design service that prioritises the green buildings ethos. 10 years ago, it renovated its headquarters to LEED standards. The building is a 1930s industrial building in Richmond, Virginia, that is on the National Register of Historic Places. The NRHP is an official list of structures and areas, quote, deemed worthy of preservation for their historical significance, ends. Listing on this is mostly symbolic, not carrying anything like the weight of listing here in the UK, and protection of the building is not guaranteed, but then it isn't always here either. LEED prioritised keeping the original skylights and garage doors to incorporate natural light, one of its goals. Preserving the historic building gained the project 12 credits. The project also included a rooftop garden, an outdoor view from every desk, a finely detailed water management plan, and the use of rapidly renewable materials such as sunflower board. BREEAM and LEED, the two leading internationally applied standards, are similar but not interchangeable. If you're looking for sustainability accreditation for a project, it may be that one is more clearly appropriate than the other, all things considered. Pursuing either, or any other type of green accreditation, will benefit a project and those engaging with it in any capacity. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, what are we talking about this week?
City bike hire.
Boris bikes.
Well, it was originally suggested by Ken Livingstone in 2007. At the moment in London, the main city bike hire scheme is known as Santander Cycles, previously Barclays Cycle Hire. It's the second biggest bike share system in the world, second only to Paris, which incidentally London's was modelled on. Curiously, London's scheme runs at a loss and takes taxpayer money, whereas Paris and Washington DC's cover their costs, and that doesn't include the cost of providing the bikes or the docking stations. There are bike hire schemes running across the UK and worldwide. In fact, pretty much every major city you care to mention has a bike hire scheme.
Liverpool, New York, Sydney.
Of course, but what we're really talking about today are hire it and leave it schemes. There are two main systems, docking bikes, which need to be returned to a physical docking station, and dockless, which you leave wherever you fancy within the operating zone. It's then logged onto the app so anyone nearby wanting to hire a bike can spot the nearest one. The latter are considered more convenient by riders and they're cheaper than the Santander cycles, but apparently the operating zones aren't respected, so bikes end up all over the place.
Lots of bikes littered about for vans to drive and collect again. Isn't the idea to reduce emissions?
These schemes have a few aims. The bikes are brightly branded, so they're a great advertising vehicle, boom boom, and it helps the city with its Look at Me green credentials. Many people enjoy cycling, and if you're in a leafy or quieter part of London, it could be a nice experience, going at a slower pace instead of sitting in traffic. That's a tourism selling point. Because you can dump the bike in a docking station, it's another way of travelling without needing to find and pay for a parking space. The docking stations and bikes themselves aren't terribly intrusive to the streetscape, and it can be far cheaper than any other form of transport in a city, bar walking. In London in particular, the bikes are intended for short journeys, so the pricing model encourages that. Frequent docking means there's more likely to be a bike free from someone else who might want it.
I feel there's a but coming up.
This type of bike hire is totally unregulated, so any supplier wanting to join the market doesn't have to get council approval. This can mean a couple of thousand bikes appearing on the streets overnight and causing a few headaches for the council. Wandsworth impounded over 1,000 bikes which O-Bike put on its streets 2 years ago.
Wow. So how many are there in London?
Over 11,000 odd. A year ago, Ofo, a Chinese company, brought 2,000 bikes to Sheffield at no cost to the taxpayer. Unfortunately, there was a fair bit of vandalism and 6 months later, Ofo withdrew and it scrapped plans for 150,000 bikes in London, although apparently that's part of company restructuring, yada yada. Despite that, rider figures are incredible. In 3 weeks, Sheffield hit the figures it took London a year to achieve, apparently. Vandalism and theft are also very high. The saddest part, though, of Sheffield's experience is that prior to Ofo arriving, Sheffield had a dock-based hire system funded jointly by the university and the council, but once Ofo arrived, that wasn't financially viable, so it folded, and now that Ofo's gone, there aren't any plans to get that going again, which is a bit of a shame.
So what works best? Private companies providing the service or councils?
There looks to be room for both, and there are advantages to be had from working together or covering different areas, but the private companies take big risks. Three have withdrawn from Britain in the last year. The private companies flash the venture capital cash, whereas councils are far more cautious. They have different priorities, metrics, and timescales. In the UK, Lime, like the fruit, which provides electric bike hire, has just launched in parts of London, and Uber has brought its Jump bikes to Britain.
Is that about achieving market dominance?
It looks like it, and new companies are popping up all the time to get a slice of the action. Perhaps it's significant that Uber, for instance, has waited to see what happens with other companies here in particular before looking to enter the market.
Learning from other companies' mistakes or misfortunes, a late mover advantage?
That's right. Providing the infrastructure, bikes and docks, is the exact opposite of what Uber does usually, so there's a need for huge expenditure on both supplying the bikes in the first place and then replacing them when they're lost, stolen or wrecked.
That must be a big problem. Does it kill the idea dead?
It's part of what has caused problems for Ofo. And Mobike increased its charges in Manchester to help cover the costs, and then it withdrew altogether from the city. In Edinburgh, out of 500 bikes, only 200 are available following a bad run of attacks, but it has had the fringe on there just recently. Derby e-bikes, who believed they ran the UK's biggest e-bike hire scheme, has shut down for good due to just unmanageable levels of vandalism.
So whose job is it to protect and control the bikes?
The apps that Ofo and other companies provide show the location of bikes, and quite a few started showing up in rivers and canals. Occasionally, this can mean that a bike's parked by a river, but unfortunately there have been many instances of the bike actually being in the water. In San Diego, California, bikes belonging to all the main dockless hire companies have been found in local waters. Some areas are tolerant of this, taking the view that overall the bikes do make a contribution to CO2 reduction and local health and all that sort of thing, but others are getting tough with the bikes providers. Coronado, an area of San Diego, charges companies $45 per bike retrieved. There's criticisms that the companies aren't responsive to requests to collect abandoned bikes. Lime Bike explicitly will not retrieve bikes that aren't directly accessible, leaving it to the local authority. This is the case in the UK too, where the Canal and River Trust says it's pulling 100 bikes a year out of London's canals. That's just London's canals. This takes up time and money that could be better spent on other projects. Some bikes, of course, make damage to boats while they're lying around in the water, so that makes them enormously unpopular. As well as pulling out of Manchester, Mobike has suspended its ops in Newcastle and Gateshead because so many bikes were ending up in the Tyne. Some London boroughs are considering fining bike hire companies £500 a pop for abandoned bikes. Similar situations are cropping up across the USA, but at the same time, the schemes are popular, so it looks like the popularity of dockless bikes goes hand in hand with problems with vandalism and abandonment.
Is there a profit incentive for companies to retrieve their bikes?
Well, without fines, you might well ask. With hire so cheap, is there any incentive? When you consider the manpower, fuel and vehicle wear and tear that it takes to pull a bike from water or wherever it's been abandoned, then the time, skills and infrastructure required to mend a bike, from a financial point of view, there's little in it for the hire scheme. Environmentally, it's a shocking waste. Since the Santander Cycle scheme increased security, there were fewer of those bikes ending up in the water, so it really does seem to be the dockless sort that are the main problem for this.
What needs to happen to see these schemes working well and delivering the benefits originally intended?
Regulation would be a good start. Companies would know the boundaries, literally, and they would all be in the same position. The Greater London Authority has proposed that TfL regulates London's dockless system. There is still one private operator of dockless bikes in London, Mobike, but its operating area has shrunk. Yobike, not to be confused with Mobike, has small dockless schemes running in Bristol and Southampton. And those in the business describe this, you know, loads of companies in the market and then loads coming out again, as a natural stage in development, learning curve and so on. And it doesn't mean that the schemes are failing.
Should councils and companies work together?
There's certainly scope for that, especially as the companies need councils' goodwill. Currently, as in Wandsworth, the bikes are seen as a problem. But with the right regulation, private business could play a big part in reducing an area's congestion to the benefit of the council.
Is that happening anywhere?
It is in Italy. Bologna's council is working with Mobike, so time will tell whether that proves to be a model other cities can follow. Lime is cooperating in the UK with councils in its intended target areas, I think just looking for the warmest reception.
So, an environmental success story?
Not unequivocally. After a day of use, bikes can end up in big groups in a few places, so they're usually manually redistributed. This involves a fleet of vehicles that have to load up the bikes and drive them somewhere else. One article I read suggested that this so-called rebalancing is unnecessary and would happen by itself, because the people who drove, or cycled, rather, from 10 different locations into central London would then, in theory, do the same journey in reverse later on. So they're doing the redistribution naturally. Apparently, when this redistribution, which sounds rather Orwellian, the redistribution drivers went on strike, the bikes carried on being used just fine, which is quite telling, really. Electric Lime bikes are collected by staff for recharging every 2 days. On the upside, this allows staff to keep an eye on the condition of the bikes. The hope with e-bikes is that the extra oomph they deliver will encourage more people to choose bike over car.
Is that happening with this sort of bike car in general? Are we leaner and meaner as a result?
At the Royal Geographical Society conference a year ago, Dr. Cyril Médard de Chardon of the University of Hull said an emphatic no. The user profile is dominated by those already in good shape and affluent enough to afford to buy and maintain a bike of their own. The vans used to drive the bikes round offset any CO2 saving. The research Dr. Médard de Chardon refers to says that this is likely to be the demographic across cycle schemes globally. The central locations of the schemes mean those in outlying areas, i.e. those more likely to be on a lower income, can't easily benefit from the schemes. Dr. Médard de Chardon suggests instead that the taxpayer money involved could have gone towards improvements in transport systems that everyone can benefit from.
So maybe more infrastructure than more bikes, or something else?
Well, there's controversy over cycle lanes increasing congestions for cars, because you might have thought, oh, cycle lanes, obviously. You might say, well, so what? The people should leave the cars at home and use some other less polluting means of transport, or get an electric car or van or what have you. And yes, that argument has legs. But the main problem is that cars sitting in traffic pump out pollution. Idling is shocking for that. So all the while that people just damn well are going to use their cars and vans, the longer they're sat on more congested roads, the worse for air quality.
Well, maybe not with electric cars, but a fair point with the old combustion monsters. So, are there any bike hire schemes around here?
Cycle infrastructure is a hot potato in Herefordshire just now, with the proposed bypass on, off again, maybe going somewhere else, and all encouraging car use in a medieval city that can't cope with it. Personally, I wouldn't cycle on the roads around here, or want the children to, because you're sharing the roads with massive agricultural plant on windy roads peppered with potholes. A network of cycle paths between our market towns and surrounding villages to replace the rail lines long gone would be really welcome. In Hereford itself, Beryl Bikes operates a hire scheme in cooperation with the council. I haven't noticed any of their green bikes around or seen any of the green parking bays, but I'll look out for them next time I'm in.
So would you use one in the city right now?
Me? Cycling in Hereford? The music industry has the potential to consume a great deal of energy in different ways. On the face of it, streaming might look more environmentally friendly than pressing CDs or actual vinyl. But streaming uses vast amounts of energy as data centres provide the service. Is it more environmentally friendly to go to a concert or festival? That market is worth over £3 billion, so let's take a look. Think festivals, think Glastonbury. This year, the festival was to be entirely plastic-free, one hell of a name. This was part of its theme this year, climate change and the environment. Sadly, there was the usual ocean of litter left behind this year. While festival organisers didn't allow any purchases to be provided in plastic, it couldn't stop attendees bringing in, for instance, plastic bottles. Considering it sold a million plastic bottles of water in 2017, selling none this year was a huge step. It even wheeled out Sir David Attenborough onto the pyramid stage to encourage festival goers to do their bit. Despite it taking over 1,300 volunteers to collect the rubbish left behind, the organisers say that this year plastic waste has been drastically reduced. So that's an improvement, but still, in the end, there's loads of rubbish to be disposed of. This isn't an audit of Glastonbury, but it does encourage travelling to the site by public transport. It generates renewable energy from solar PV on a cattle shed roof, incidentally one of the largest privately owned solar PV installations in the country. It generally takes a proactive approach to renewable energy, also using wind and a ground source heat pump. It's installed an anaerobic digester to power offices and backstage areas. Use of generators is being reduced, low-energy lighting is installed, and attention is being paid to using local services for food and a drinking water supply. The energy policy page on its site even reminds you to unplug things if your house is going to be empty while you're at the festival. As a major player in the festival market, where Glastonbury leads, others should follow. Last week's Reading Festival tackled another aspect of thousands of campers in one place for 5 days – human waste. Gas from pee and poo collected on the site will generate a gas used to power homes. Already, Reading Sewage Works produces 50% of all the electricity it uses. The contractors just need to make sure that the tents, sleeping bags, mobile phones and beer cans that typically end up in festival loos are removed first. Something similar but on a smaller scale is on show at Glastonbury, provided by the University of the West of England, Bristol. The EU identifies the music industry as lacking energy efficiency information and training and relevant financial schemes, so it has introduced EE Music, developed specifically to improve energy efficiency in the music event industry. It used workshops and training schemes to deliver information to over 2,000 festival organisers, venue owners, supporters and attendees. EE Music has developed tools for delivering energy efficiency improvements in staging music events and launched EE Music in 10 countries. On its website, it describes itself as, "Over the last few years, EU-funded project EE Music organised workshops all over Europe to inform music professionals about the industry green IG tools, i.e. a free calculator measuring the energy efficiency of a festival, club or venue, and comparing the energy data over time and within the music sector." Ends. This is a small start, and initial findings show a very varied progress across EU countries. Eastern European countries, for instance, show little appetite for energy-efficient music events, whereas the Netherlands applies established energy efficiency and sustainability measures. In Bulgaria, for instance, very cheap energy prices make going through an audit unappealing, it's kind of not worth it. So in Bulgaria and similar markets, including Czech Republic and Hungary, focus was shifted to other areas, such as raising awareness and probing the market. EE Music found that the music event industry is fragmented and overlaps with many other industries, including, for instance, tourism. It's dependent on existing suppliers, so if there's just one venue in an area enthusiastic to reduce energy usage and/or find a source of renewable energy, it will struggle to make any impact. Many small venues and festivals otherwise interested in using EE Music's guidance couldn't access what they needed locally to make changes and couldn't take their plans further. Live Nation Entertainment, which describes itself as the world's leading live entertainment company comprised of global market leaders, which includes Ticketmaster, Festival Republic and C3 Presents, has taken a stand through its project Empowering the Earth. Through this, its greenhouse emissions will align with the Paris Agreement. It intends to achieve this by reducing the environmental impact of its venues and events, taking care of the communities where it operates, and inspiring all those it comes into contact with to take similar action. Maybe concerts and festivals aren't for you. Instead, you stay at home and stream music. There's no travel, no outside catering, no massive speakers or 5,000 miles of electrical cable. It's clearly far less energy intensive, but is it better than buying a CD or record? In an article earlier this year on April the 13th, International Record Store Day, Energy in Demand reviewed this subject. Energy in Demand is a weekly online review of low carbon energy transition. It found that music has shifted from a commodity industry to a service industry and prices have plunged. Few of us now expect to pay a great deal for access to music stored in the cloud. The environmental cost, however, is huge. Plastic use has plunged from 58 million kilos in 1977 to just 8 million by 2016, but that pales compared to the energy used by the data centres delivering streamed music. These two different data sets can be compared by translating them into greenhouse gas equivalents, or GHGs. In 1977, GHGs were 140 million kilos. It's now over 350 million kilos, well over twice as much, and that's just in the USA. As Energy in Demand rightly points out, to make a crystal clear comparison, we would have to take into account all sorts of factors, including the energy used to make record players, to ship CDs and records to shops, etc. And this was years ago when polluting was normal. Then there are the emissions from recording studios and making musical instruments. The list really does go on. Where do you stop? What we need to keep in mind is that today, when streaming music is a standard way of listening to it, the purchase price and the environmental cost bear no relation to each other. What's the answer? Should artists take responsibility for using energy-efficient methods to play, record, and perform their music? Should consumers buy more records and stop streaming? Should streaming platforms and music labels ensure they use only the most efficient data centres to host their wares? Bear in mind that artists now make virtually nothing from music sales and have to generate revenue instead through live performance. One group of musicians has decided to do something about it. Australian bands, including Midnight Oil, have joined FEAT, F-E-A-T, a platform encouraging the music industry to embrace sustainability. FEAT began when Heidi Leffner, keyboard player with Cloud Control, considered the environmental cost of an upcoming tour. She approached climate scientists and worked with Dr. Chris Day to calculate the impact of a two-week tour within Australia. Dr. Day calculated that the fortnight's tour would produce emissions equivalent to those produced by an average household in a year. Given the distances involved in Australia, the band flew between cities, and Leffner wanted something better than carbon offsetting. She believed her creative industry could find a solution. She came up with FEAT, Future Energy Artists, in partnership with superannuation fund Future Super and developer Impact Investment Group. Through FEAT, musicians can build and invest in their own solar farms. The first is underway, an 80-hectare site in Queensland. The bands involved are investing for their future, literally and metaphorically, and they can invest from just $5. The Queensland site, Brigalow, can power 11,300 homes for 30 years, or power 2,000 cloud control tours. Artists can expect a return on investment of 5% a year. Leffner hopes this initiative, based on community solar projects in other countries, will catch on with musicians building the solar industry the world needs. Green Riders is a campaign encouraging artists to include energy efficiency and sustainability measures in their touring conditions, commonly known as riders. This is the I demand pink Smarties and green tissues in my dressing room sort of business. Green Riders' website includes suggestions such as asking the venues you play at to switch to 100% renewable electricity, using refillable bottles to eliminate plastic bottled water for artists and crew, and working with venues and promoters to help them go single-use plastic-free. Also use sustainable merchandise, for instance, t-shirts, CDs, records. Green Riders believes that if enough artists take action in this way, they can change the music industry. It's supported by Julie's Bicycle, a charity founded by the UK music industry. It supports the creative community to do something about climate change and works with an impressive list of organisations including Arts Council England, the Brit Awards and the Royal Albert Hall. Many of the same issues face classical music, maybe without the festivals. Orchestras spend a great deal of time touring, but Orchestra for the Earth goes to great lengths to minimise its carbon footprint as it fulfils its mission, that music can provide a fresh approach to engaging people with the environmental movement. End. To this end, it tours Europe in a coach rather than flying, which also has the benefit of avoiding losing valuable musical instruments at baggage reclaim. This year, the orchestra opened a nature reserve in Austria, funded from donations made at concerts. All ticket sales for Orchestra for the Earth performances include an element for planting a tree with the Eden reforestation projects. This works in countries including Haiti, Nepal, and Madagascar to replace trees in deforested areas. And what have we been up to? We're looking at some very interesting changes to our business model. We haven't finalised them yet, so we'll share when we're ready. We're still seeing good international sales just at the moment, so with Brexit on the horizon, we recommend you buy while international shipping is still a straightforward known quantity. Thank you for listening to episode 13 of the Energy Efficiency Podcast. Until next time, you can find us on both Twitter and Instagram as EcoFlap, and on Twitter we also tweet as the PetFlap. In next week's episode, we'll look at the WELL standard, energy efficiency in public transport, and the realities of recycling textiles.